This is Brian Feldman, October 3rd, 1992. Developmental Approach to Analytical Psychology, Tape 1 of 3.
Consultant to the university health clinic, where some of these people would come for psychotherapy, but in the mental health clinic at the university, they were only able to be seen for 10 or maybe 12 sessions. And it was quite clear that with the level of disturbance that some of these young women had, that they would need to have a more intense analytic type of therapy. So I specialized in the analysis of bulimic and anorexic young women over the years, as well as young men who often come with identity disorders, sexual identity conflicts, drug problems, things of that nature. So I have also dealt quite intensively with that male population. And I think there are distinct differences between identity conflicts in men, in young men, and in young women. And I think it might help to go into that somewhat, to understand what the gender differences might be. Furthermore, I think it might be helpful also to go into more about Jung's own adolescent period, because I think in that way we might begin to understand how analytical psychology has begun to deal with adolescence and what attempts Jung made to deal with that in his own work, especially I think in Symbols of Transformation, where he's talking about the hero archetype and the deliverance from the mother. This I think is quite critical to understand in a beginning way, to understand the development of theory in terms of adolescence. So these are some of the things that I'd like to present, as well as I have a number of slides of clients' artwork while they've been in analysis, as well as poetry and things of that nature, artistic expressions, which seem to be so important in terms of giving expression to a deeper sense of self in analytic work. So again, I'd like to go around the room, and if each person could introduce themselves and say a little bit about what they would like to get out of the workshop, what they like to focus on, this would be quite helpful. Cindy? I brought two cases, one of a male that I saw in analysis for about 4 years, and he was coming, I believe, about usually four times a week. So it was a very deep analysis of somebody who had suicidal impulses, sexual molestation perhaps earlier in life, had very difficult drug problems, had been in residential treatment, and whose parents were quite concerned that he wouldn't make it through adolescence, which was the reason why he came into analysis, and he asked for it himself. The other is a case of a woman who I saw for 4 years, who was in analysis 3 to 5 times a week, except during a period when she was in the hospital. She was severely bulimic, was a very bright, gifted artist and university student. And really, of her, I have a great deal of, she was very interested in painting, and work through all of the sensorial aspects of her infancy through painting. And I have her slides. She's given me permission to show those. And the young man was a musician and a poet, and has given me a number of his poems that he gave me permission to read. So I'd like to perhaps use these as you know, sort of starting off points for our discussion, and please jump in. But briefly, with Jung's adolescence, and I touched on that briefly, and I think for me it was always a starting off point, because I think Jung had a very difficult adolescence. And part of the difficulty, of course, in his adolescence was finding his own identity. And so much of the identity issue had to do with this torturous relationship with his father, who he felt really, again, did not have an experience of true spiritual belief, but merely went through the motions of his religious practice as a theologian. And I think all through Jung's adolescence, there was some search for the mentor, some search for a male role model. And as I stated yesterday, there was some evidence that he had been seduced sexually by a mentor at the age of 18, which I think is a curious event, because at the age of 18, a young man is usually conscious of his own sexuality, and the issue of seduction often goes both ways. In other words, there was a tremendous father hunger, I think, inside of him, which often can become sexualized. And I bring that up because often in the male adolescents I see, the older adolescents, the sexualization of the father hunger is often quite confusing for them. There's a lack that they're trying to, in a sense, sort out and to consolidate inside of themselves. And often because adolescence is such an intensely erotic period, that this search for father can be eroticized in some ways. And I think in Jung's case, it seemed to be not only with the older person, that he doesn't mention who it was, but somebody he respected a great deal, but also in the case of Freud, whom he really fell quite in love with and was in great conflict about. He said that his veneration for Freud took on some sense of a kind of religious fervor, and he was in deep shame and embarrassment about this. And I think in part it was Freud's not being able really to understand that deeply enough that led also to their breakup, because Jung was in such conflict around these feelings. It's also interesting to note that the letters, when Jung mentioned this to Freud, some of the only letters that are missing in the exchange are right after that revelation of his. In other words, Freud's response to that. So this is also, there's something very deep that was going on in terms of their communication. And again, this identity issue, which in part was related to adolescence and in part also related to what had gone on before, which was coming up yet again.
When you say it was unusual for Jung to have this sexual encounter with another man at the age of 18 or 19, what do you mean? Not a sense of a draw as well?
There might have been. I think he was in great conflict around his sexuality in adolescence, and as I was reading quite carefully through his description of his adolescence, what he did was often what many adolescents do. He went very much into the spiritual realm very quickly and in a sense evaded his own consciousness and experience of his body and of the erotic side. There's one episode where he discusses a relationship with a woman, a young girl in adolescence. I'm not sure if you remember this, but it was when his father had bought him a ticket, I believe, to go up to visit where Nicholas, brother Klaus, is it? Nicholas von Klaus had a hut, a kind of hermit hut. And he went to the mountain and he was just walking down, and this girl, he didn't know her name, he knew nothing about her, but he felt there was some destiny drawing them together, and he felt enormous conflict that he wasn't able to talk to her about all of his philosophical conflicts, that he was reading Schopenhauer and Kant and different spiritual things, but he felt there was something very special about this encounter with this, in a sense, unknown girl. You know, walking, they had this sort of spent several hours walking down the mountain together, barely even talking to each other. Now again, he's recounting this in his 80s. So the intensity of that, even that one experience, indicates to me the tremendous eroticism of that encounter, yet no sense for real communication around that. You know, that he even discusses that he had no contact with young women during his adolescent years, that he was quite, again, solitary and closed off. He had few friends, male friends as well, that he was quite closed off and quite solitary. But can you imagine the impact of this as the most important encounter between Jung as a man and this other young woman in adolescence was with a woman he didn't know her name, he barely talked to her, yet there was some great feeling of destiny, something stirring inside of him at a very deep level, yes. And in my work with adolescents, often what comes out is the enormous eroticism, the enormous sense of sexual arousal that can come up, as well as the potential for great spiritual contact, because the energies, in a sense, in the body and in the mind are awakening so much, and also there's such an increase in self-consciousness. It's the first time of a deeper consciousness of I am someone, you know? But also the conflict about who that I is in terms of the identity struggle. And this is, of course, where then the identifications in earlier childhood and early adolescence make so much of a difference. In other words, some adolescents, let's say, who aren't in great conflict are able quite easily to identify with either parent. But in cases where there's struggles with identification, as in Jung's, there's often great conflict. And I think this also came about in Jung's case in terms of his search for a true self, which he described that conflict as the struggle between the number one personality and the number two personality. The number one personality was very much the persona, the false self, the part that was just in the world. And the number two personality was the deeper true self, which was connected to the unconscious and to the deep intuition that he had and premonitions about things. He calls it even the connection with the natural mind and the archaic aspect of himself. So again, this is something that we see often in adolescents who feel very false and phony and are looking for some deeper connection to self and really struggling with that, but they're feeling that they often are living a false life, you know, that their life doesn't make sense, that there's no meaning in it, and that there's a search for a deeper meaning, especially in gifted adolescents. And of course Jung was quite gifted. In the gifted adolescent, there's much more consciousness, but also much more angst, anxiety at a deeper level, and dread about what this deeper self is. And this need to make connection is so deep, yet such a tremendous struggle, you know? And often the sexual acting out is a defense against intimacy. And this sense of wanting to connect with somebody, again, becomes paramount. And then this was the same with Jung. He said he never really trusted anybody, yet he was always looking for somebody to talk to. He couldn't really talk to his parents about his struggles. There was nobody really there for him to talk to.
Could we say that his relationship with Tony Walton, with Sabina Spielrein, sort of returned to having being married, very kind of return to reaching out for his adolescent belief, uniting the body with the spirit.
Yes, I think so. I think certainly with Tony Wolfe, who he called his mystical sister, certainly there was that connection. But in some way, it couldn't be completely integrated. And this is what I was trying to get at last night. There had to be remain a split between the mother, who is sort of with the everyday, and Emma with the five children. And I think he, in some way, was being mothered by Emma, but that couldn't contain the sort of the much deeper, in a sense, mystical part of himself, which seemed very much contained with Tony Wolfe. It was, I think, it first came up in terms of his young adulthood with Sabina Spielrein, but what happened there is it got completely out of control, and he wasn't quite sure what to do with it, because he allowed himself to cross over some of the boundaries in terms of their relationship. And then she was a very gifted yet a very disturbed woman in many respects. She had been hospitalized at the Burghölzli for a psychosis. And he really, in a heroic way, had gotten her out of that. And she was able to go to medical school, and she was able to become an analyst of some renown. And because of her break with Jung, moved to Vienna and worked with Freud for a number of years before she went back to her own country, to Russia. So I think that he was struggling with this. The intensity came up in these relationships, but early on it was very difficult for him to deal with it. But I think Tony Wolfe provided for him a container for this side of himself, this number two personality, the more deeply mystical, spiritual side of himself.
Brian?
Yes?
Do you have a sense of what Jung's father's adolescence?
No, there's very little about that, except that he came from a family where many of the siblings were theologians and pastors. Apparently, eight of his uncles were also on both. Now, there were, you know, eight in each family, but mom's family there were eight, and father's family eight. But there's very little said except that they came from rather humble circumstances, and Jung grew up in a sense deprived environment, materially deprived environment. And there's much talk about his not having proper clothes and his feeling sort of odd and different from the other children because his dress wasn't appropriate. He had holes in his clothes and the house wasn't the same as some of the other kids' houses, things like that. But do you have any sense of this?
I would remember reading, I think it was in Gerhard Ware's biography,
yes,
that Jung's father was a gifted philologist.
Mm.
And that he had already begun to make contributions there.
Uh-huh.
But then money was set aside
for
someone who would study for the ministry.
Okay.
And there was no money for what it sounded like would have been his call.
Yes. Jung says in his biography that his father, was, I believe, specialized. He had written a dissertation, the father, on the Song of Songs, and was a specialist in Hebrew, but didn't, after he finished this dissertation, and this goes along with what you say, didn't continue with that type of study. And whether there was great disappointment or not, there must have been, that his destiny was never fulfilled.
Yeah, there's a sense that he really did not. You were saying going through the motions. The sense I get was that he was really anguished.
Yes.
He really knew there was not anything he could do about the fact that he was kind of mired.
Yes.
In this structure that just so cuts off whatever life there is.
Yes.
And that really impacted him.
Yes.
That was my sense.
I think so. I think so very much.
I'm just wondering a little bit. I don't know how objective I can be about any of this, but it seems that there's a tendency to idolize Jung.
Yes.
Obviously here for that reason largely, but in saying that he couldn't contain some of these aspects of the self that led him over to Tony Wolfe, and his saying that his father wasn't truly spiritual, so I wonder how objective we're being, and whether or not we're really looking at how selfish or Emily Jung was a pretty deep woman. I mean, there are levels in which one might expect that he wasn't willing to work things out, and what we would say today would be maybe more expected. But I just wonder if you have a sense of how objective the searches into Jung's life have been, and why we need to have.
Exactly. I think this is very important. I think it's important not to be judgmental, but I think it's, and to try to understand the development of our own practice in science in some way, and a sort of blanket idealization of Jung is not that helpful, because it tends to block our own inquiry into areas that he might not have gone into. And what I would agree with you, it's hard to be objective, although I think it's important to be analytical. And what I'm trying to do is to be analytical about the originator of this particular science, and to utilize the tools that he's given us to analyze the theory and the man himself, you see. Because Jung, of course, said he was not a Jungian. He was himself, but he had all these followers that were Jungians, and quoting his collected works. And I think he, too, realized how dangerous that was. So my feeling is the more analysis we can do of the early history, the better we are, because we can begin to think about these concepts and realize that they're not reified. In other words, that they're not sort of in stone, and that it preserves, I think, the creative integrity of the work if it can be looked at analytically. So I think the more analysis we can do of this, the better. Even though, of course, we don't know what objectivity is, because each of us has our own subjectivity, and we're always looking at it with a subjective bias. You know, it can't be analysis. Of course, depth psychology is not a scientific endeavor in the true science sense of the word. I mean, there are no control groups. Statistics isn't going to help us very much. You know, all of these things. It's not science in that way. It's a kind of introspection and dealing with subjectivity. And I think if we try to make it objectivity, then we're in for trouble. And that's when people become very firmly entrenched in a particular position, be it Freudian or Jungian or Kleinian, you know, where only the works of that particular person is seen as reality. So I think to bring analysis to this early period and to understand the theory itself analytically tends to free us up for more creative thinking and can energize us in a certain way. So it's sort of a tool for ourselves to understand this and not to be so literal about subjective experience, because Jung's psychology, as we see, and I think he stated, was the, in a sense, the elaboration of his own subjectivity, his interest in alchemy, Gnosticism, typology. This all came from his own experience. It wasn't from the books that he read that got him interested in that. It was basically from his own dreams, fantasies, and experience, deeply subjective experiences. And I think the same holds for Freud. And I'm sure for me, I don't know enough about Melanie Klein's early history, but I'm sure there's evidence of that, you know, in terms of all of this emphasis on envy and hatred towards the mother and destruction. I mean, she was, from what I've read, filled with that with her mother. So it's I think all these things are very important to understand, so we don't get too caught up in thinking that there's just one truth. I mean, we each have our own truth that we have to be very honest about, and then we need to explore from our own experience what makes sense in terms of our experience with our clients. So this is what I'm very much trying to get at. Anyway, why don't we go, I just wanted to use this material about Jung, we can go back to it later or whatever, as a kind of preface to discussing some perhaps clinical material now and get into that so we can begin to have some discussion. Now I'd like to discuss this particular case. It's of a male adolescent whom I've named Ed. And he came to me when he was 18 years old. He contacted me by phone. And he contacted me in a very unusual way because he was asking for an analysis right off the bat, which is very unusual. It's the first time that happened to me. So I wasn't quite sure what was going on. The voice on the phone sounded quite unsure and hesitant, and I found his request so unusual at the time. When I had seen adolescents in the past, it has been quite unusual for them to request an analysis outright. Usually I see them in once or twice weekly psychotherapy before starting analytic work on an intensive basis, if that makes sense. Often it doesn't. I mean, it really only makes sense to me to see the adolescents intensively when they're quite severe difficulties, character problems, personality difficulties, etc. So I was naturally intrigued and curious about his request. I told him that I'd be able to see him for one session to give him a chance to meet me and for me to find out more about his situation and his desire to be analyzed. At that point, he told me that he had been given the names of two analysts by a child psychiatrist he had had several interviews with, and the child psychiatrist had told him that it would be quite helpful for him if he did have an analysis. He gave the one analyst, one name that was given to him by the child psychiatrist was a Freudian analyst, and the other, myself, a Jungian analyst. And Ed was quite undecided about whether he wanted to have a Freudian or a Jungian analysis, and he was quite caught up in these sort of intellectual ideas about what it would mean to see a Jungian or a Freudian, and he decided to have interviews with each of us to find out what these people were like.
So he's just person,
who's
a normal person, not from an institute or anything?
From an institute? No. he was I'm not sure I call him a normal person. I mean, certainly each person is an individual. This was a person in deep, you know, the exterior presentation was very sort of cool, calm, collected, and sort of intellectualized, but clearly he was in deep, deep distress. And I've never met an adolescent who wanted to have an analysis. Uh-huh. It seems almost a sort of contradictory term. He was very bright, but very distressed. Adolescents usually don't want analysis or therapy because it means being dependent on an adult parent figure, which is exactly what they're struggling to get rid of. Yes. So this is why adolescents are often very difficult to engage analytically. When I first met Ed, he was quite hesitant and unsure of himself, yet articulate about his current situation. He told me that he was eager to have an analysis because of his current predicament. He had been at a residential treatment center specializing in adolescents with drug problems for 2 years. And during the last few months, he had enrolled as a freshman in a college, which was 100 miles away from his home, where he was living now with his family. Although he had done well at the residential facility and felt he had made a good deal of progress, his adjustment to college had been filled with stress and anxiety. He was having difficulty focusing, concentrating, and maintaining interpersonal relationships. He was not doing well academically, and he had failed courses. He felt like a failure, as he was not able to succeed at something he felt he should be doing well at. And this was after 2 years of treatment. He was told he should be cured and everything should be better, but he was having this terrible time at college. He just couldn't put his attention to it, and he was having a great deal of anxiety about relationships. During the first interview, I decided not to elicit a detailed history, as Ed was so tentative and unsure of himself and the analysts that he might want to see. We focused a good deal on his current situation. He was living with his parents, no longer using drugs, and was trying to find a job. He said that previously he had used drugs extensively, mostly marijuana and hallucinogens, and that they had gotten him into trouble emotionally and academically. As a child, he was not able to attend the local public schools due to truancy and oppositional behavior, and had to attend special private schools starting in the sixth grade. After our first interview, Ed told me that he wanted to interview the Freudian analyst and that he would get back to me if he was interested in pursuing treatment with me. He asked few questions about analysis at that point and seemed not to have so much intellectual knowledge about the process. During the first meeting, I did have a good feeling about Ed. I liked him and found him approachable and emotionally related. I mean, he was quite eager to sort of get something and to focus. He wasn't really resisting it. He was quite open to trying something. I did not feel that he was either closed off emotionally or overly anxious about starting treatment. His openness and eagerness to start seemed to indicate to me the level of consciousness about his current concerns and distress. He felt stuck in his ongoing psychological development, and he had no idea what direction his life would move in. He appeared uncertain about his goals, his choice of a career, his friendships, his sexuality, and intimate relationships. In spite of all of this, I did feel a rapport, which made me feel that I would be able to help him analytically if he chose to work with me. And I try to really rely very much on my own sort of initial emotional response, kind of transference. It gives me a guide to whether I feel some process might be possible. And I really try not to provide too structured an interview in the beginning, but just allow the adolescent to present themselves in whatever way that they want to. That really gives them some sense of being able to be themselves without having to, in a sense, perform by asking a lot of detailed questions. And I didn't hear from him for a week, and the next week Ed called requesting another interview to discuss further his having an analysis. He decided at that point, he told me, not to pursue a Freudian analysis on the basis of his interview and the feelings he had about the analyst. I said, well, that's interesting. Why don't we discuss that and what he thought he might want at this point? And when we met, Ed said that he had felt somewhat put off by the Freudian, as he told Ed, in other words, the Freudian analyst, that he had too many external difficulties, and that in analysis, he as analyst did not want to deal with so many external issues. And of course, he was very put off, and I think felt quite rejected, because the analyst was in some way saying, well, we only can deal with internal conflict here, we can't deal with your real life. And my position was, well, we need to deal with what you bring here. And if it's your real life issues, we need to deal with your real life. And if it's things that you're feeling, you're thinking about, you know, your development, we'll talk about that. But I didn't want to provide any framework for what we, in a sense, needed to talk about. I found the comment perplexing and felt that there may have been other aspects at work which influenced Ed's reaction. I knew that the Freudian analyst was senior at the Institute, and he practiced classical Freudian analysis. Perhaps Ed had projected aspects of his father, a successful professional with whom Ed was embroiled in a tense and hostile relationship, onto the analyst. Ed said he felt more comfortable with me, that I would talk to him about his external and real life, that I was younger and therefore to him easier to relate to, and that this would make treatment more viable for him. I told him it would be helpful for me to get to know him a bit more, to understand his current situation, and that I would need his permission to have one session to talk to his parents, to discuss his being in analysis and the responsibilities that they would have. I also gave Ed the choice of being present at the parent conference. And so I told him from the outset that I would want to meet with his parents, but only once, just to get to know them and to begin to have some, you know, they would have to understand the treatment and what might happen and what my sense was of Ed. But I also told him, and this is certain, also the way I work with adolescents, that I have actually very little contact with the parents. And this is another aspect of adolescent therapy that's so difficult, is that it's important for the adolescent, I feel, to have some place for themselves, some safety, and they don't feel that their material is going to be conveyed to the parent. It's really very different working with children, younger children, than working with adolescents, because with younger children, we really need to have the contact with the parents, because the little child is not going to be telling us what's happening at work, at their work, at school, which for them is work, and what's happening at home. But I need to have the parents' collaboration in that respect. In adolescence, the whole situation is reversed, because they need to be, we need to, I feel, form an alliance with their healthy side, and even with their adult side, in order for the analysis to work, not with their more childlike side, you know, which is often in great conflict. And they're embroiled, as he was, in trying to separate from parents. During our next interviews, Ed began to tell me about his life. He was upset about his parents' marital situation. There was much arguing in the house, and Ed thought that his parents were headed for a divorce. Both parents were in individual as well as in couples therapy, but it did not seem to help their situation. So there was a lot of therapy in this particular family. The sister also was having a lot of drug problems and had, as well, was even at the residential institution that he had been at the time when I began to see him. So the whole family was quite distressed, and they were all seeing different therapists. Each parent had their own individual therapist as well as another therapist for the couple, and then I was going to be brought in.
How usual was that?
Not very usual. I think it says something about the level of distress and dysfunctionality in this particular family, that something was really going on. And yes, and this is what came up. Ed stated that he always remembered a difficult and strained relationship with his father. He immediately went into his father, who was a recovering alcoholic, yet a highly successful professional who had acquired considerable wealth. He felt closer, yet also in a curious way, conflicted with his mother. He had uncomfortable sexual feelings in her presence, and this was unusual. In the very first sessions, talking about his incestuous complex with his mother. So there was a lot of unconscious material that was always coming up, even from the very beginning. It was as if the barrier between consciousness, the unconscious and the conscious mind, was not very firm. It was quite permeable. Because adolescents usually don't talk about incestuous feelings in the first interviews. That doesn't come up until much later. So he had uncomfortable sexual feelings in her presence, and he felt that perhaps she also had these feelings towards him. He wasn't quite sure who was having the sexual feelings. The parents were having sexual difficulties. The mother, he felt, and he were having some type of sexual tension, and he wasn't sure about father. She had recently told her mother that she had been sexually molested by an uncle she had trusted as a child. So the mother had been incested by this uncle. And Ed wondered how that had affected her sexually. He did not feel that his parents had a satisfying sexual relationship and thought that this was another area that was leading them to divorce. Ed also mentioned that he had been sexually molested by an admired woman teacher several years ago, and this caused him a great deal of distress. The consequences of the molestation were devastating to him, as he had reported the incidents to his parents, and they proceeded to have the teacher decertified. And this was a very difficult situation, because also this was not only a teacher, it was also his therapist, and then he had been living with her as the teacher. She sort of took him on because the parents didn't know what to do with him. And then she, the teacher, around giving an explanation about needing to educate him sexually, decided to engage in a sexual relationship with him. And then he felt in great conflict about this, and his parents, he told his parents, and then they proceeded to inform the state licensing board and all of this. And then he felt guilt-ridden.
Question, was this during the time he was in the treatment center?
Right before the treatment center. He really seemed to have gone over the edge. The incestuous material seemed to be present for some time, and whether he was acting out the maternal unconscious in terms of her molestation, or if it was other unresolved Oedipal issues within himself, I think, you know, it was unclear to me at the time. But there was a lot going on, and at the same time, he felt betrayed by the teacher. He was also quite attracted to her and felt very privileged and special that she would have this relationship with him. So there was great ambivalence inside of himself about this. And he too seemed to feel, like Jung talks about this spiritual special relationship. He thought he and the teacher had this special spiritual relationship which was above any other relationships that normal people have. And that she had somehow convinced him that he was one of the select few on earth who had some special powers and abilities. So there was quite a complicated, quasi-delusional, folie à deux, fantasy, spiritual system. I'm not sure what to label it, but it seemed very entangled. Ed seemed to hold a great deal of guilt about this, yet he also felt a sense of betrayal and sexual confusion, as he mostly felt sexually attracted to older women. He never really felt sexually attracted to women his own age as he was an adolescent, but he felt this enormous attraction to older women. He was confused as to why he was not more involved with women who were similar in age. He felt that this could be related to feelings of inadequacy about his body, which he went on about at great length. He felt that both his nose and his penis were too small, and that his lips were too large. He said this was the whole problem with his issue with himself, was this sort of external body image stuff, which I think, again, with adolescence, indicates the enormous kind of cathexis, the enormous charge that the body has in terms of identity. And these were his deficiencies, and he related it to the nose and the penis. He felt skinny and ugly and feared that more appropriate women would not be attracted to him. So he kind of gave me, in a capsule way, what these issues were that he was going to need to be dealing with. This enormous sort of hatred of the father. He didn't like the father. He couldn't identify with the father, who was so successful in the outer world, but also an alcoholic who couldn't really be available to him when he was a child, because the father would come home and just start to drink. He was having a terrible conflict with his mother, who had been sexually molested, and apparently her sexuality and unconscious sexuality, whether conscious or unconscious, I think both, had deeply affected his own sexual development. He was embroiled in incestuous conflicts with his mother. He wasn't sure whether the origins of these sexual feelings were in himself or in his mother. He had been through an experience of sexual molestation with a teacher he had greatly admired and loved, and was really very conflicted and guilt-ridden about that. He had been on drugs for a period of time, wasn't able to concentrate, was severely depressed and suicidal, had been sent to a residential treatment center for a couple of years, which was supposed to have cured him, but which didn't. And then he sort of landed, this is what his casual conference, sorry?
Told
him it would, of course, do that. And what, I'm sure they tried to help him as much as they could from what he told me. And then he says, well, nothing's worked. Now I'll try an analysis. You see, it was sort of the treatment of absolutely last resort. This is why I say adolescents rarely choose analysis. It was really what he was telling me, this was the end of the line. And this is usually what happens with the adolescent when they decide to come into analysis, is that they've tried sort of everything else, and this is it. And so they'll give this sort of strange treatment a shot. Any questions about this initial thing, this initial material, and then I can go into some of the actual sessions. I'd rather not discuss any personal details, only that he was a professional and he was quite successful. It was sort of an artistic, it was a creative profession that he was involved with. But I don't want to give any information that might identify him. But it was successful, he would cut the memories that Ed had of him that came up with that he would be at work, he managed his work quite well, but he would come home and start drinking. And he wasn't a sort of nasty person when he was drunk, but he was just completely unavailable. He would sort of be, you know, in his chair, and he would have been drinking and watching TV or something like that. But no, there was no feeling of an interaction between he and his father, which was the real missing element. And it disappointed him greatly. And the issue of the penis was very much related to his not being able to identify with any phallic aspect of his father, and somehow his own body was damaged, and all of this became elaborated on as we started the analytic treatment.
Is he an only child?
There was a sister, I mentioned just very briefly, who was younger, I believe 2 years younger, who at the time that Ed came to me was in the same residential treatment center that he had been in. And what I knew about her was that she was had very deep problems with drugs, more serious drugs even than Ed did. And the parents sent her there they thought that she might kill herself because she was using cocaine and she was out with wild guys and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So it was very serious and they were really frightened about her.
So how old was Ed when his father quit drinking?
Well, he quit drinking, but I don't think he ever quit being an alcoholic.
He
was a recovering. I mean, he seemed to have an addictive personality that came out of it. And it was a curious split because the father seemed quite creative and productive in his business life, but he just couldn't seem to carry it over into the personal sphere. It was quite split off. Is it possible to cut down? Can people hear me? Was that too much problem? Or?
I'll post this. And it is hallucinogenic psychedelics and marijuana.
Did they revisit that?
Yeah. I just think that he has a better chance than his sister.
Yes. Sure. Not as debilitating, I don't think, as cocaine, but on the other hand, he was using it quite a bit and he wasn't able to concentrate. He apparently had, what he would describe is that he had a very low tolerance for marijuana. It would just sort of send him into a very spaced out place and he couldn't really function. So,
separated from the body.
Yes, completely. And a lot of sort of suspiciousness and paranoid delusions would come up and hallucinatory phenomena and a lot of the sense of being the special chosen one in this spiritual universe. And it was only, he would read this, Demian and Hesed, all of these many books were very interesting, but he would identify so much with the characters that he was different from everybody else, you know? And on the one hand, he felt like one of the most special people in the world, and on the other hand, he felt like a piece of shit. You know, and he was struggling with this polarity between the grandiose self and the sort of deflated self. And the marijuana would sort of flip him out into either the grandiose or into very sort of suicidal, debased feelings that he's just a piece of shit with a small penis and a small nose who can't really do anything, you know? So it was this sort of juxtaposition that he was struggling with, and the drugs did not help him integrate that. Had been going on for a long time. I think it was about early adolescence. I think he had started, somebody had given him mushrooms or something when he was about 12 years old. Apparently, you know, he grew up in a time when that was quite, in the area that he was living in Palo Alto, it was quite easy to gain access to. And there were those sort of acting out kids that would get involved in that in early adolescence. Oh, yes. These were just the first initial sessions. So I just wanted to see if you had any questions, and I can get into the actual analytic material, because all of the stuff around that came up.
I am curious more about a clinical question.
When sure.
You're doing this kind of intake, is this just all material he's offered, or are yes. you questioning and trying to go get certain information?
I don't really try to get information from adolescents or even from the adults in that way. But, you know, my feeling about that is that I'm not there to extract information. I'm there to provide a certain type of space where that individual can explore themselves in the way that they need to. On the other hand, I do follow up on things that he brings up. And I sort of, you know, I try to, in a sense, my attitude is to try to maintain a certain naivete. In other words, that I try not to know rather than to know. Because my feeling is when I know too much, then I really don't know what's going on with the client. So in that way, I try to maintain an open mind and a certain state of receptivity to the client. But I didn't make specific inquiries into, well, how much drugs was he using and exactly, you know, when did it start. I didn't really want to pry into it. I didn't want to set myself up as a sort of authoritarian figure. You know, the way that I work as an analyst is much more in an, I try to create a much more egalitarian atmosphere. You know, certainly he's the client, I'm the analyst, and there are clear boundaries, but I try not to force the interaction into a highly structured, sort of hierarchical interchange. So I try to give him as much freedom as possible in terms of his expression, because I thought that in these initial sessions, what will come up is probably what's important to follow up on, and that the other things, well, we'll just have to wait and see. You know,
would encourage him to expound on what he had brought up, maybe?
Yeah, to explain. Could he tell me some more about that? Or not really to ask questions per se, but to have a dialogue, you know, or could he elaborate his feelings about this? I mean, it was truly a dialogue about what was happening or what he thought might happen, you know, things of that nature. And this was really the beginning of an evaluation. And if I could, I was trying to get a feeling of could he really work analytically, you know, because the analytic situation is so unstructured. So this was my evaluation, and when I completed it, I discussed, you know, it briefly with Ed, and we decided to embark at that point on a 4 times weekly analysis, as he was eager and motivated to receive help. He actually asked to come 4 times a week. That was very important. I think that, again, indicated the level of his distress. He also decided not to attend the session I had planned with his parents. When I did meet with his parents, it was interesting. I felt they were quite sophisticated, yet very confused about the conflicts Ed was experiencing.
Is he living at home now?
Yes, he's at home. Ed's father spoke openly about his alcoholism and the impact that must have had upon Ed growing up. He was quite fixated on the alcoholism as the major problem. His mother spoke about the sexual molestation issue she had recently begun to work on in her therapy. And they both spoke about their couples therapy, and they were quite eager for Ed to see me. Everything sounded at the surface level so good and sort of congenial. You know, everybody was quite interested in this, and of course it would help, etc. While the parents were able to talk in depth about Ed's current predicament, they had few recollections of his infancy and early childhood. It was almost as if it was a blank. I mean, it was the most uncanny experience for me. And I did ask them about, could they tell me anything important about his early infancy or childhood? And it was just blank. She said, you know, just little things like Ed's birth and delivery were uneventful, as was his life up until age 6. So there was a sort of dark continent. Something felt amiss in me and my own feeling. Something was wrong here. I felt a bit relieved when his mother spoke of surgery for skin cancer when Ed was 2 years old. Not relieved that she had cancer, of course, but that there was some trauma that had happened, and the cancer occurred after the birth of Ed's only sibling, a sister. Ed had not told me yet about her. He never mentioned a sister. She didn't come up until much later. I never knew, if he had a sister or not. From what Mother said, she had been separated from the children for several weeks and had been severely anxious after that for some time. I thought that this prolonged separation and Mother's subsequent anxiety could be one explanation for his feeling that his mother of infancy was unavailable and detached.
She had
a skin cancer, and apparently she had to be hospitalized for several weeks. I think it was quite a serious one, stage of cancer. I found out that his sister also had profound problems. She too, and so the parents told me, had been seriously involved in drugs and also attending, as I said, the residential treatment center Ed had gone to. Ed's parents seemed to understand the severe nature of Ed's conflicts and his blocked development. They were fearful that his pattern of failure could become a lifelong problem. They were supportive of his having an analysis and were willing to pay for it. Both Ed and his parents saw it as an alternative, this is what they said, to his going to a private college, which he couldn't attend because of his concentration difficulty, and something that he would need in order to proceed in his psychological development. This was the only face-to-face contact that I had with Ed's parents during the course of his analysis. There were several phone contacts during the course of our work, and it was actually over about a three and a half year period. But these were always conducted with Ed's consent, and the content of the calls was not hidden from him. So I did reveal what was discussed. I really didn't want to have any sort of behind his back contact with parents. I wanted Ed to have a sense of a contained analytic environment where he would be able to explore and investigate his psychological and emotional conflicts with as great a freedom as possible. And now the initial phase of treatment. Ed's beginning phase of analysis was filled with hope and promise. He was eager to form a relationship with me and relieved that someone would be taking care of him. He came consistently to his 4 times weekly sessions, which were conducted on the couch. During the first week of analysis, Ed reported his first dream as follows. And often the first dream in analysis is so important as it sort of indicates the whole psychological scenario of the analysis. And his was quite interesting, and it did lead to this, I think. And this is the dream as he reported it. He was quite hesitant and a bit embarrassed about the dream, as you'll see, but it was clearly quite pivotal. He says, "I pulled up in front of a house in my dad's Jeep. I was lost and shaking. I said to myself in a questioning manner, 'What town is this?' A man was in the house and he invited me inside. I was wary of being diverted. I insisted on knowing what town it was that I was in. I went into the house. The man was talking to me. There was a large table in the room. There was a big sex toy near the ceiling, which was lowered on a chain. It was made out of a soft material. In the front, there was a penis, and in the back, there were 2 legs. Later in the dream, I did not have clothes on. I was thinking that I was horny, and this guy wants me to suck his penis. I'll do it. I don't care. When I went out of the house, there was a truck that was backed into the driveway. Somebody was in the front of the truck, and I asked again, 'What town was this?' They looked at me like I was pregnant." So this was quite a dream. I'm not sure, would you like me to read it again? Because it's really so very important. Would it be helpful? And adolescents don't often report dreams right off the bat. So it was a very interesting dream. And again, it points to how permeable this ego barrier was, that the unconscious was just sort of coming up quite quickly, deep unconscious material. Again, the dream. "I pulled up in front of a house in my dad's Jeep. I was lost and shaking. I said to myself in a questioning manner, 'What town is this?' A man was in the house and he invited me inside. I was wary of being diverted. I insisted on knowing what town it was that I was in. I went into the house. The man was talking to me. There was a large table in the room. There was a big sex toy near the ceiling, which was lowered on a chain. It was made out of a soft material. In the front, there was a penis, and in the back, there were 2 legs. Later in the dream, I did not have clothes on. I was thinking that I was horny, and this guy wants me to suck his penis. I'll do it. I don't care. When I went out of the house, there was a truck that was backed into the driveway. Somebody was in the front of the truck, and I asked again, what town was this? They looked at me like I was pregnant. So maybe we should pause and just get some of your reactions to this also, so we can have a dialogue, and then I can describe what his associations were and how we began to deal with this dream. Any thoughts about this dream?
The first thing I think of is his identification with his father, going up in his father's truck, and his own addiction to drugs, and relating his father's addiction to alcohol, perhaps, you know, identifying with his father in that kind of distinction.
Anybody else have any reactions to this kind of a dream?
Overwhelmed by a distorted masculine and having very much to do with trying to decide a life direction which is inauthentic, but he gives in, and somehow it seems to play with the sexuality where it's really, he really gives up all his integrity.
The kind of passivity. And his not knowing about whether he's feminine or masculine, you know, whether he should be in the feminine position in terms of the fellatio and then he becomes pregnant, or whether he's masculine and then there's this sort of inanimate sex toy. You know, there's this symbol, but it's not really humanized. And then he's not sure if the sexual desire is coming from himself or the other person, and he's sort of quite passive about that. It's sort of all laid out here, and he's confused where he is, and where he's going, and what's this town all about, and what's he doing there. I mean, it was tremendously anxiety-evoking.
It seems that one of the hopeful signs is that there's some insistence on knowing where...
Yes, yes. He says, oh, yes. He says, what does he say? I insisted on knowing what town it was that I was in. I went into the house. It was like he was insisting on this analysis. You know, this was what this was about. He's going to insist that he has this treatment. But the search for the phallus and the meaning of the phallus, I think, was so difficult for him.
Hanging from the ceiling, chain.
Kind of a sadomasochistic sex toy of some sort, like a prop where it's dissociated from human contact.
And interesting that it's in the upper realm of the room.
What do you make of that?
The alcoholic connection. The father is also, his father is distorted and
yes.
In the air.
Yes. This came up a lot in his dreams, the issue of the genitals being detached and somehow inanimate. They couldn't really be attached to the body. And his own, one of his major complaints about his own penis and his own body image, you know, being somehow damaged, was all quite important. And he feels, I think, quite naked. He says, I did not have clothes on. I mean, he's not really, there is no persona. A persona in adolescence is quite important in some way to have a barrier between the unconscious and the outside world. But for him, there was not a very well-constructed persona. You know, he wasn't sure who he was, and all these deeper feelings were coming up, spiritual, sexual feelings that he was quite overwhelmed with. And then there was this sort of projection onto the other person, as with the mother. You know, maybe she has these feelings towards me. Maybe the teacher, you know, it was the teacher who had these feelings, in a sense, confirmed that. But also there was a lot coming from him that he wasn't able to really sort of own and feel integrated with.
Was it a sense with the people at the end looking at him and seeing him pregnant?
Yes. It was mixed. I think it was quite hopeful that he could have something inside of himself, in a sense, the kind of analytical baby. I mean, the new self, the new birth, in a sense, what I would consider the baby archetype. You have to be fertilized. I think in analysis, the baby archetype comes up a lot, that there's this new self that's going to be born, you know, that you're going to be giving birth to. And it's like a birthing process. On the other hand, for him, It was also related to being a woman, to being more womanly. So in a sense, this bisexuality issue, you know, is he a man, is he a woman, and he's sort of attracted to these older women, yet he has these unresolved homosexual issues. This was causing tremendous confusion and great anxiety for him. So it was quite a struggle. I think both, you see both the anxiety element, the conflict-ridden element, as well as the more hopeful prospective element in terms of the baby archetype and his being pregnant. But it's an important issue. Yes?
Can you describe the look so that he knew that what people were thinking? There was that trick of omniscience in dreams anyway.
Yes.
But the vernacular would be to look at me like I was crazy, you know? And
yeah.
Instead, they looked at him like he was pregnant.
Yeah.
And just to imagine that kind of look on someone's face that would give you that knowledge of yourself.
Yes, it was like they were looking at him as a man who's pregnant. That's what he says.
That's the way. Did he give him any more details?
Well, I asked him to associate. I wanted to sort of get your associations first, because it's always fun to do, you know, interesting to sort of see what comes into your own minds, play with the material. Isn't it, though?
Because
I thought it was interesting to imagine such a dream in the beginning. I mean, just to make it, to have it sort of be a creative product of the unconscious in this way. It was also a gift to me, you know, that he was coming in the beginning and he's sort of pregnant with all of this stuff, and maybe he needed me to see him as filled with this kind of potential. Although at the same time, you know, needing me to see him as a man and not as this sort of androgynous figure that he was struggling with separating, you know? All these things, I think, were interesting. Anything else about this interesting dream?
What do you make of the truck?
I'm sorry, the truck, yes. It's interesting synchronicity. The truck. What did I make of the truck? I don't know. It was his own, you know, I mean, the truck was very much, for me, it's interesting. At first he's in a Jeep, and it's his father's Jeep, but he's lost and shaking. You know, he's trying to go be on his journey, and he's trying so desperately to identify with his father, but he just can't do it. He's sort of feeling all lost and shaky about it. And then it's interesting, he says, when I went out of the house, there was a truck that was backed, just like this one, backed into the driveway. So I don't know if there was some anal aspect to that, you know, in terms of his own fantasies about the pregnancy, or whether it was that like a truck filled with interesting things, you know, that might take out and bring into the analytical environment, you know?
Just given the family dynamics you described, he's sort of carrying around more than his share of stuff.
He was carrying a pretty big load. You know? And I think that the analysis was to sort of unload him of a lot of furniture and baggage from his past that he was carting around with him. And I think using the drugs, et cetera, to sort of to deal with, it was just too much for him to deal with the mother's stuff and to deal with the father's stuff. And then he was, you know, dealing, he didn't tell me till much later, but trying in a sense to father the sister, you know. It was very, feeling so sort of overly responsible for everything, and then his own life falling apart.
Was the truck that backed up, did he say if it was full or empty?
No, I get into his associations now. When I asked Ed to associate to this dream, he made the following remarks. He said, the older man was short, dark, with straight hair, and about 40-ish, and he reminded me of you. He said, I felt that the man wanted to seduce me and that this brought up my fear about what had happened when I had sex with my teacher. So he was here starting the analysis, and he, you know, had this person that he revered and idealized so much. And he was, of course, very anxious. Well, was that going to happen here in some way? I mean, he was carrying around this trauma with him. This is really what he wanted to focus on. He said, this first dream, it delineated, I think, many of Ed's psychological conflicts and pointed to issues in the transference-countertransference relationship, which would be important in our work. In addition, Jung has mentioned that the first dream in an analysis often has an important significance, as it can delineate the psychological material which shall emerge as the analysis progresses. In this dream, Ed's transference relationship with me is expressed with great clarity. He fears that I could seduce him, as he was seduced by a teacher he admired and respected. He may be used in this sense to satisfy the desires and demands of the other. This is only a partial explanation of the sexual erotic content of the dream, as he says that he became sexually charged before a sexual enactment took place. In this sense, Ed's own more suppressed sexual desires are being given some expression. Ed and I reflected together on this dream in some detail, as I thought it could represent symbolically a paradigm and structure for the analytic work. In the beginning of the dream, Ed is in his father's Jeep. He is lost and shaking. This seemed to represent how difficult it was for Ed to identify with his father, and points to the difficulties Ed had internalizing a coherent father image. He is lost in his father's vehicle. He is not sure where he is or where he is going. He does not have his bearings. He is anxious about his predicament. This, I think, reflects his conflicts over finding an adequate identity for himself. He does not feel that when he is associated with his father, that he knows where he is going. His concept of father internally is that he cannot help him find the right direction in his life. He feels lost and does not know where he is now or what his destination is going to be. The next part of the dream, where the man asks him inside, I think is related to the analysis. He perceived me, and rightly so, of inviting him to be analyzed. His wariness of being diverted represents his fear and anxiety about the analytic work. Will it be helpful to him? Will it enable him to get where he feels he needs to go in the future? When he says that he, quote, insisted on knowing what town it was that I was in, he is describing the urgency of his plea for analytic help. He is saying that he needs to know where he is going and where the analysis is going to take him. Then in the dream, the man is talking to him and Ed goes into the house. In a parallel way, he has entered into the analytic consulting room after I had conducted a psychological evaluation and discussion with him to determine where he is psychologically. And then I have used this discussion to help us get our bearings, to find out where he is now and what the dynamic forces are that are going on inside of him. As the dream then progresses, things become more murky and more sexualized. There is a large table in the room, and a big sex toy is lowered from the ceiling by a chain. It was made out of a soft material, and in the front there was a penis, and in the back there were two legs. Ed related the sex toy to his childhood masturbatory activity and childhood sexual play. When he was 4 years old, he engaged in sexual play with a male playmate. He allowed the small boy to urinate into his mouth, and this led him to feel humiliated. He spoke about this incident with a great deal of shame. In addition, there were soft objects that he would utilize to masturbate by rubbing them against his penis so that he would become excited. This is all this sort of sensorial stuff, you know, that was also in terms of this masturbation, some way to sort of calm himself down. His own sense of phallic excitement is contained in the image of the large phallic sex toy. It appears that he was first conscious of this when he was 4 years old, and entering into the Oedipal period of child development. Then in the dream, he reports that he does not have clothes on, that he became, quote, horny, sexually excited, and that he thinks that the man wants to perform fellatio, that the man wants him to perform fellatio. Ed does this in the dream. The desire to engage in oral intercourse, I think, represents symbolically Ed's need for a close and physically intimate relationship with the older man, older male, and some way of incorporating some phallic aspect of the male. Ed had not discussed homosexual relationships with me at this point, and I did not want to inquire into them, as I felt the dream was more related to suppressed sexual desire for his father that arose in the Oedipal period and that was being transferred onto me in the present. So I was really trying to stay quite present, focused with him, to try to establish our analytic relationship and not sort of delve too much in the past. I mean, he sort of brought these things up spontaneously. But I felt it was so important to sort of get our bearings and find out where we were, rather than delving too quickly into very deep, unconscious material. The need for close sexual contact with an older man seemed to indicate both what had been suppressed as well as the desire for a close and intimate relationship with an older male in the present. While the molestation by the female teacher was in the background of our discussion about the dream, I think that both Ed and I felt that the dream seemed to be more related to his emotional state and his desire for male influence, symbolized in the dream as fellatio. When he goes out of the house, there's a truck backed into the driveway. He indicated that there was a man in the truck who he again asked directions from. The man looked at him as if he were pregnant. The truck backed into the driveway could represent mother's body. This I did not discuss with him at the time, but this was more my thinking. The truck backed into the driveway could represent mother's body, which contains the father's penis and mother's babies. I mean, all of these sort of riches inside of the mother, symbolically. His primary envy of his mother's body and her reproductive capacity, which I thought might be related to his own seeing himself as pregnant, is here dealt with by his becoming pregnant through oral intercourse with his father. In addition, the fellatio could be a symbolic representation of his negative Oedipal strivings, that is, his desire to be in close sexual contact with his father and his jealousy of his mother's ongoing sexual relationship with father. Children in the Oedipal phase often conceptualize impregnation and the conception of babies as taking place through oral intercourse. This is very common, I think almost perhaps archetypal, but very much based on the body development, that children that I have seen will always discuss, if the issue comes up of how babies are made, and you sort of ask them, well, how are they made, that somehow the father puts a seed inside of the mother and she swallows it and it goes into her tummy and the baby is born and the baby comes out of the anus. It's sort of based on their own conception of their own bodies. Things go in, they change, and they come out. Often children describe fantasies of what I just said, a father placing the seed inside of a mother's mouth, which then grows into a baby in her stomach. The baby is often thought to emerge out of the mother's anus, and the birth-giving process is then associated with defecation. The pregnancy in the dream could also be related to his desire to conceive an analytic baby with me. The analytic baby would then be symbolically related to the birth of a new sense of self. As we worked on the psychological implication of the dream over the next several weeks, and we really stayed with it. It was interesting. It was one of these dreams that you could sort of stay with because he kept him very interested in analysis and what this all meant and to try to look at it symbolically. He had that capacity. Ed appeared to be able to engage me increasingly in an analytic relationship where we could reflect together on his internal psychological states and try together to generate psychological meanings in a state of collaboration. I think that this initial dream is quite important, as it elaborated all of the significant issues Ed was coping with at the time, and it brought them immediately into the analytic relationship. So you see, the dream sort of provided the stage for the evolution and the consolidation of the working alliance and the analytic relationship. And I think in his case, he needed to, in a sense, bring me his deepest anxiety in the very beginning and to see how I would deal with it, because he had all these disappointments before in his treatment. And people really weren't able to deal with the deeper anxieties. You know, either they were dealt with concretely, as with the teacher who seduced him, or he was in a situation in the residential treatment where they were dealing a lot with enacting initiation rites and doing a lot of symbolic stuff, but sort of things that were given to him from the outside. It wasn't really from within himself. So he felt it wasn't a really true, often experience for him, that he was trying to do something which wasn't quite in sync with his own internal sense of self. So I think it was also a test. You know, he brought this dream. Well, what can you do with this? You know, let's see how you're going to deal with this stuff. And so I thought it was very important to go into it slowly and carefully. Should we take a break?
Well, we should at some point.
Well, we can take a break because now it's going to go into the, you know, into more of the analytic material.
Discussing with him over the next couple of weeks.
Yes.
In what way did you, how differently from the way you just discussed with us were you discussing with him?
Sure. I think what I tried to, my memories and my feelings about what I tried to do with the dream was to first very much put it in the sort of present-oriented feeling of our relationship, and to try to distill, I tried to, and I think, dispense some of his anxiety by making it discussable, and that I felt in one way it was a transference dream, first and foremost, and that we needed to discuss it in terms of our relationship, and then perhaps he'd be less sort of suspicious about my motives or and this terrible trauma with the teacher, which I took very seriously. You know, that he was so anxious about forming a relationship with another person that he might idealize that would then collapse. So I took it in a very, I didn't try to sort of take it backwards in time or into these deep symbolic interpretations at that point. I tried to keep it very focused on our relationship and the evolution of our relationship as much as possible. And then I thought, after he felt a deeper sense of security with me and a deeper sense of holding, and that we could think symbolically together, then the analysis, you know, could go into another phase. But first we had to sort of clarify the relationship, and he needed to understand, well, what does it mean to sort of think analytically with an analyst, you know? So I tried to keep it in that framework in the beginning.
On that level of dealing with the transference dream, how did you deal with the truck? My sense somehow is the truck back up in there.
Yes.
Is blocking this exit from the house.
Please continue. And how would you feel that in the transference?
The people in the truck, getting in the truck, then telling him about pregnancy, etc., that brings it on a different level.
They don't tell him. They said that they looked at me like I was pregnant.
Okay.
See, there's this sort of omniscient aspect which other people have brought up, the magical.
But somehow, the truck back in
yes.
there looks like...
I think he was bringing his truck in there. I felt strongly that it was his truck. It was, again, a representation of himself. And he needed, like this truck out here, he needed to unload. Sort of, let's bring this stuff in here. You know, let's get my furniture out in the open. And so it can be dealt with. That was the, it didn't have a sense, I didn't have a sense so much that there was a blockage. But that was my own feeling. I mean, perhaps, I'm not saying, a dream can have many meanings. It's not just one meaning. And the meaning of the dream is what really is created in the moment with the analyst. We can generate other meanings and other contexts, you know?
Just a sense of you stepping out into the
yes, there's a big, something there is big. And sure, it was impeding his progress in his life. But he had a lot of stuff in storage, as it were, and it's, this was the feeling of the dream, to me, at that moment, with him.
I kind of felt like that in listening to this part, that even if it wasn't his truck,
yes.
it was a truck that could be unloaded, but the potential for unloading existed. And that the notion of this possibility
yes.
in entering the analysis,
yes.
Something maybe hoped for.
Yes.
And now his psyche is giving him this image.
Yes, I think so. And, you know, he was at the end of the line, as it were. I mean, if I can't convey enough the sense of desperateness which this young man had. I mean, it was sort of the last chance for him, he felt, to progress. Or else it would have been, he felt suicide. You know, it was just going nowhere. Anything else, and we can take a little break? Okay, what are we doing? School, the archetypal school, and the developmental school. Are people familiar with that, or perhaps I can go into it? Well, sorry? What I can say briefly is that the classical school is usually what's considered the Zurich-oriented school of Jungian analysis, where there's a great deal of emphasis in the analytic work on the interpretation of dreams, the use of active imagination. Usually the client, I think in the more traditional Jungian sense, is helped. And I had a period of analysis myself in Zurich. The emphasis is to help the analyst then really develop a relationship to their own internal process. And it's, so the focus is really the internal symbolic world, briefly stated. And I think some of the major proponents of the classical school certainly would be Neumann, von Franz, Yolande Jacobi, people of that nature who have written quite extensively. Then there's what's called the archetypal school of analytical psychology, and this is actually quite prominent in the United States right now, and its major proponent is James Hillman. And I can't say as much about the archetypal school because I don't have a lot of personal acquaintance with it except through some seminars and things that I and other encounters I've had with James Hillman over the years. And when I've discussed the analytic process with him, what they tend to do, the archetypal school, is to stay very strictly in the dream material or fantasy material and not to, they're very careful not to relate it to the personal material. This is what James Hillman says, and when I've questioned him about it, they try to work within the dream metaphor itself. He has the patient, analyst, recount the dream, to tell the dream again, and to just stay within the dream metaphor and to amplify it mythologically. So the personal element, he feels, is not include. It's not necessary to include it. So he doesn't. He tries to work away from a transference relationship developing. He doesn't want the transference relationship to develop. He feels that can be an unnecessary encumbrance, and he tries to develop what's called the imaginal space for the client.
The what space?
Imaginal, to work within the imagination itself.
He seems to be quite critical of psychotherapy.
Yes, he's given that up. Yes, I think it's sort of a more developed stance on his part in terms of this. And that's always perplexed me, as Stanson, and I've taken up some of my perplexities with him, but he clearly states that he doesn't believe in the transference relationship, he doesn't believe in exploring people's personal past, but he does believe in helping them become much more in contact with their dreams and their imagination and their creativity. Okay, then there's encounter, well, sort of, it hasn't developed in conflict with that at all, but there's another school of thought, which is more what I've come from my own thinking, which is called the developmental school of analytical psychology. And one of the original people within the developmental school was Michael Fordham in London, who tried to integrate, I think, some of the Kleinian way of thinking into Jungian thought. And in the developmental school, I think it's clear in the way that I work that I don't see a distinction between the personal and the archetypal. The way that I work is to try to integrate both the fantasy material, the dream material, with the, on the one hand, the transference, counter-transference relationship, so it's quite rooted in the reality of the relationship, as well as to understand, to help the analyst understand their own development in their own way, their own narrative way, their own mythological way, but that they do, they need to be grounded in a sense of a personal past, a personal present, and a personal future, and that it encompasses the life cycle, you know, and that also the personal aspects are very critical. Probably the major differentiating feature between the classical school and the developmental school is that, for instance, the adult clients and even adolescents are usually seen on the couch, and often the frequency is a bit more, you know, 3 or 4 times a week rather than with the developmental. And there's much more emphasis on the transference and counter-transference relationship, the discussion of that. Now, of course, each person comes to it in their own way. Myself, it's sort of what I think a person is more in sync with. I've always had an interest in developmental psychology and working with children, but also in my own analysis, I had a period of analysis in Zurich, but I never felt that type of analysis really fit for my way of being. And it's interesting, when I came back from Zurich and started graduate school at Berkeley, I entered analysis with a Freudian, which I found actually quite helpful. during that period of training. On the other hand, my internal life has been much more, in a sense, Jungian, in terms of the material that comes up and my own sort of interests and predilections towards the unconscious and spirituality and creativity. So I, of course, after my training in graduate school, started a Jungian analysis and went to the Institute. But in San Francisco, we have a number of analysts that also work on the couch more developmentally. So for me, personally, I was not able to be analyzed face-to-face because I had too many intellectual defenses to incur. I needed to have a more deeply regressive and deeply, immersion, a deeper immersion in my own unconscious processes, which I needed to be in a state of reverie to achieve, which I could achieve much more easily on the couch than face-to-face. So for me, doing analysis with adults, it's much more comfortable to create an analytic space if the client is on the analytic couch, and I can be more also in a receptive state of reverie. So I prefer to do the analysis that way, and I also feel strongly about the grounding of the material and the transference-counter-transference relationship, that it gives it a kind of basis. And I think attachment and connection is very important, so I'm not afraid of the deeper dependency that can emerge within. I think it's all.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.